Activists mark the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday as Black Lives Matter protests continue around the country. Duval schools are ordered to stop publishing COVID-19 data, and thousands of students are unaccounted for. And the Jaguars meet to discuss the social justice movement around the country, and they even hire a new social responsibility executive. Those are some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, local restaurants are joining the racial justice movement. We'll tell you how. But first, it's Friday, and yes, it's been yet another busy week in the news. We're pleased to welcome back to the show David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Regular contributor and WJCT board member Charles Griggs is up today. Hey, Charles.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Hi, A.G. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And rounding out our foursome, writer and journalist Claire Goforth. Hi, Claire.
Hi, good morning.
So good to have all four of you on the show. Lots of news to get into this week. We'll go to your calls in a few minutes at 549-2937. Join the conversation. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Even as Florida's test results remain more than 5% positive for coronavirus, the Department of Health says the state continues to see new cases adding at a stable level. 3,269 new cases of COVID around the state yesterday added, including 263 in Northeast Florida. 249 deaths linked to COVID-19 here in our area. Now, those numbers meant social distancing was in effect Thursday as activists marked the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday. In August of 1960, civil rights demonstrators in downtown Jacksonville were beaten by a racist mob as they attempted to integrate downtown lunch counters. At the newly renamed James Weldon Johnson Park yesterday, Councilmember Brenda Priestley-Jackson said the unfinished business of that movement today involves fixing longstanding inequities in this city. Let's listen.
Septic tanks that need to be removed, crumbling infrastructure, economic development not viable or visible in certain parts of our city, disparate educational outcomes and opportunities.
We want your calls as we talk about the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday and the racial justice movement happening across the country. It's 549-2937. Share your thoughts and comments with us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. We need to note the newly named Johnson Park has also been added to the African American Civil Rights Network. The U.S. Secretary of the Interior issued that proclamation yesterday on the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday. Charles Griggs, that was an important piece of symbolism, given that the Confederate statue in Heming Park came down only weeks ago, and the renaming of the park is brand new for this city. So there was a lot of significance on hand at the events yesterday. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, Melissa, plenty of significance around the naming of the park. A lot of controversy as well. We've seen legislation being proposed to rethink the way we actually do these types of things. But in terms of Axe Handle Saturday and the commemoration, this is a point in time where we probably may not have had as much attention paid to this event had it not been for a lot of the activities that had been going on post George Floyd murder and some of the other civil unrest activities going on throughout our country. It's good to see that that attention was paid to this, and we hope that this is a point in time where activities and not only just activities, but policy gets moved forward to address a lot of the information and that comments that that Councilman Priestley Jackson mentioned during her speech, noted that August 1960 was some 8 years before the start of consolidation here in Jacksonville. So we know that a lot of these infrastructure and race-related neglect in Duval County has been long occurring prior to consolidation.
That's right. There is a social justice committee of the city council looking at these issues, trying to direct funding to underserved parts of this community. At the same time, David Bauerlein, the Times Union, reports today that the Jaguars players met with their coaches yesterday to discuss how they can be part of the professional sports participation in the national racial justice movement. They were thinking about canceling their practice Thursday in response to the police shooting of Jacob Blake. He was shot several times in the back Sunday by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The New York Jets, the Packers, the Colts, the Titans, the Broncos, other teams decided not to practice Thursday. This after the NBA walked off the court. Other sports leagues joined them in solidarity. And so this goes beyond the events in Johnson Park. It is now part of this professional sports conversation. And it came up, of course, last night at the Republican National Convention as the president presented a very different picture of what we're seeing with these protests happening nationwide than what the Democrats talked about at their convention. What are your thoughts about the role of professional sports in all of this and how we're seeing that play out in Jacksonville?
Yeah, the Jaguars have been really an interesting dynamic in all this. My colleague, Gary Smith, who obviously covers the Jaguars for our newspaper, has written that they are or were the first team as a team to actually get involved in the Black Lives Matter protests. And that was an event back in early June. And they all went over there as players, coaches, front office, a big unified effort. So the Jaguars have been really very interesting in terms of how they have kind of been a force for moving public opinion in terms of some of the positions they've taken. Now, the big issue has been beyond that, how do the Jaguars as an organization have any kind of impact in the community? Obviously, Shad Khan, the owner, put out a really powerful statement against racism a few days before that march by the Jaguars over to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office building. So I'm really interested to see what the Jaguars are going to be doing in concrete ways going forward.
Right. If you're just tuning in, it's our First Coast Connect Friday Media Roundtable on 89.9 WJCT News. We'll go to your calls in a moment. It's 549-2937 to join us. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. You know, the Republican National Convention wrapped up last night with an address by the president on the South Lawn of the White House. Democrats were quick to criticize that political theater, saying the White House isn't an appropriate place to stage a political event like that. We saw a number of Florida faces take part in the convention all through the week, including Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez and former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk in the context of this movement happening in America right now. Let's talk about it in the context of the presidential campaign, which is going to kick into high gear after Labor Day. And Florida is obviously going to be an intense focus of both the president's campaign and the Biden-Harris campaign. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that the Trump campaign on the balance did more to stroke Florida than Biden did during his convention. We can recall that Nikki Fried spoke during the Democratic convention, but Val Demings, the Orlando congresswoman who was on the VP shortlist, did not speak in that kind of way. And I think what the Trump campaign is going to do is they're going to use the Black Lives Matter, the protest, specifically the violent protest, as a backdrop for their law and order message. I mean, people are saying the law and order message is outsized, it's ridiculous, but it's something that they're willing to play out for 70 days. We see it time and time again with close elections in the state. We saw what Rick Scott did to Bill Nelson. We saw what Ron DeSantis did to Andrew Gillum. The law and order thing works because sooner or later, there's enough people who see something that represents a threat to them that turns them, and that's what moves people to vote. That's how you get these like 51 to 49 elections that Republicans love to win. So Joe Biden is in a box here. Joe Biden's got to keep the protesters, the left, in line, while at the same time not getting too aligned with them, and that is a tough, tightrope walk for an almost 80-year-old man to walk.
Yes, Claire Goforth, yesterday we saw Vice President Biden speak about this. his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, also talked about these events. And they said, you know, they feel it's ludicrous to say that Joe Biden's America would be chaotic and lawless when these things are happening under the administration of the Trump White House. So depending on where you stand politically, you view these things very differently. And I'm curious, I know you cover this in your journalism work, and you've also covered the QAnon movement, which is a conspiracy theory on the right that's also factored into our political climate right now. What about AG's comments that the law and order message that the Trump campaign will certainly be pushing over the next 60 days, will that gain enough purchase to win Florida or not?
You know, it's time will tell whether or not it will gain enough purchase to win Florida. I can say that I went to a QAnon event in Jacksonville on Tuesday night, and it was attended by about 100 to 150 people. There was so many speakers. That was like a machine gun spray of speakers. And many of those people did specifically reference violent leftists. This is a narrative that we're seeing the Trump campaign and Republicans generally have been clinging to. What that narrative ignores is the fact that a lot of these protests that at times can turn unruly and at times violent, they are inspired by violence by the police against Black people, primarily Black men, such as the Jacob Blake being shot 7 times in the back on Sunday night on camera. We're not going to see fewer of these unless something changes in the terms of how police interact with the community at large and the Black community specifically. So the Biden campaign, I definitely agree with AG that it is a bit of a narrow tightrope that they have, but each time that we see these police violence incidents, the Biden campaign can say, is law and order what something that we need more of, or do we really need reform? I think that's going to be the question that they're going to want to present to the voters.
We'll go to your calls. Let us know your thoughts on the news of the week and the presidential race at 549-2937. Charles Griggs, here's an email from Mark in Orange Park. I attended the Axe Handle Saturday 60th commemoration in Johnson Park yesterday. I was frustrated that so few white people attended. As a white person, I wish others would take the opportunity to publicly come together with our fellow African Americans in our city and recognize the courageous history of the civil rights movement, he says. You know, the protests that have happened nationwide have been multiracial, multigenerational. It's important to note that they've included families, moms, young people. The people that come out and protest during the day are not always the same people that are looting and wreaking havoc at night. That message often gets lost, though, doesn't it, Charles?
It does get lost. And here in Jacksonville, we are really challenged with inclusion. One of the problems that we see here locally, like yesterday, is that oftentimes when we have an event that is targeted or commemorates something in the African-American community, we don't get a large turnout from a global spectrum of the citizens here in Duval County. And that is frustrating because there are so many cultural things that can take place that people can enjoy that don't necessarily line up with some of the traditional events that have gone on here in the city. But especially when it comes to dealing with issues such as race, people are afraid to talk about it. They're afraid of being uncomfortable when it's something different than what their life experience is all about. And that's what this country is going through. That's why we have differences of opinion when it comes to a police officer, how he reacts to a Black man in the streets. People get uncomfortable when they know that if that situation were the other way around, we would have probably a totally different outcome. We see video from both sides, right? That show that when altercations are made with officers and white people, that those altercations oftentimes turn out different. And when you have situations where people are trying to make that case and the obvious cannot be seen, you're going to continue to have folks divided when they don't want to acknowledge or recognize or feel uncomfortable recognizing events like Axe Handle Saturday.
Lots of calls for our Friday Media Roundtable. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the top stories of the week here on the show with Charles Griggs, Claire Goforth, A.G. Gankarski, and David Bauerlein, and yours truly. And you, give us a call. It's 549-2937. John is on the South Side. Good morning, John. Go ahead.
How are you doing, Ms. Melissa? Good morning to everybody.
Good morning.
As we see today, it's happened again with Mr. Blake. I mean, just like the brother just said, we know there is a disparaging amount that happens to African Americans. We see videos where a white person beats the police up, takes the car. Not one time are they tased or shot. So we keep going over this, oh, well, you know, it can't be racist. All of the police can't be racist. But like I like to tell people, listen, in order for you to deal with the problem, you cannot just look at the branches and the leaves. You have to go to the root of the problem. And the root of the problem in America is that Americans don't like to admit it. We like to cover up. But African Americans has always, whether it's a Republican, Democrat, it does not matter, okay? Right now, Biden and Ms. Harris, okay? It sounds good, but I'm telling you, the young people are not being fooled by it. Yes, we got Trump in there, and it seems like the Klan is the whole administration, as you can see. Psychology was done that people that carry racist thoughts make bad decisions.
But John, so you know, it sounds like you think that no matter who gets elected president in November, things won't substantially change. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, Miss Melissa. And the problem is basically the immunity. Before they gave the immunity here in the state of Florida, everybody talk about the three strikes. Well, the three strikes was done here in the state of Florida before it was signed into law. I seen my friend get shot in the back. So it's not as if changing of an administration is going to change that.
John. And I want to talk about the point you raised, which is qualified immunity for police officers.
Yes, ma'am. Right.
Yeah, thank you for that.
See, that's,
okay. Claire Goforth, I know you've written about this. We did learn the name of the police officer in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back as he was reaching into his car. This has outraged people who have been participating in the movement for racial justice and calling for police reform. Now, we don't know all of the facts of the case. We do need to stress that. But the point the caller got to was that, by and large, if a police officer shoots and kills someone, most of the time they will not be held accountable in a court of law due to something called qualified immunity. And that is part and parcel of the fact that police do a very dangerous job. So they are protected from these kinds of the kinds of things that a normal civilian would go through if they shot and killed someone else. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, qualified immunity certainly does factor in to protect police because of the nature of the work that they do. And the law basically lets them shoot people with impunity. I mean, they're privileged to use deadly force in a broad range of circumstances, and there's nothing that can be done about it. That's why when we see these shootings so often, there's no accountability. I mean, you know, the caller referenced three strikes, you're out, for people with felonies, that they just go to jail for life. Why don't we have three strikes, you're out for police? Instead, what we see is police who have had, in some cases, dozens of complaints for excessive force, and they're still out there doing the job, because it's very difficult to, even on the administrative level internally, to pursue any sort of real repercussions against police. I mean, if you look at the data from JSO, you look at the numbers of complaints that they have, and the numbers of officers that are actually punished, it's a very, very small percentage. And that is a deep part of the problem that people reference, because while most of us would probably agree that maybe the majority of cops are not out there using excessive force, the few that are don't lose their jobs. And so they're out there and they become increasingly emboldened by this lack of consequences.
549-2937. Tara on the north side. Go ahead, Tara.
Yes. So I have family in Seattle and LA, and they're right now participating in the Black Lives Matter protest. And as the last caller said, us young people of this generation, Biden and Kamala Harris, it does seem nice to hear, but at the same time, it doesn't change anything. We're seeing throughout history from the civil rights movement, even when our people try to do any kind of change, the government only makes small changes because it affects their economy. That's not going to work with Biden and Kamala. I mean, no offense, but another old white man is going to try and tell us that there's going to be change. That doesn't inspire any young people of color that anything's going to change. If anything, the power is going to be in our hands, and no matter what, it doesn't matter if it's Trump or Biden, it's the government itself that needs to change, because they're just really puppets, the president.
So, Tara, does that mean that you won't vote? What will you do in November?
We will vote, but when it comes to the president, it kind of seems like it doesn't matter. But when it comes to the people that run our communities, that run our schools, there will definitely be more change. And I feel from that small change can create a bigger change. And maybe, just maybe, we'll have a president that's not so much as a puppet, because this Congress hasn't done anything since the Congress of 1812. And that's all I have to say.
Wow. Okay, Tara, thank you. David Bauerlein, lots of cynicism out there among our local electorate. And they don't seem to be too enthusiastic about the possibility of real systemic change around these issues in America, and think maybe it can only best be accomplished at the local level. Let's talk about what's happening at the local level when it comes to activists pressing the city council, pressing JSO to consider reforms, consider reallocating some of the police budget, reallocating some funds to underserved communities. For the first time in many years, the city is taking a hard look at that. But what can we reasonably expect to come out of this process?
Well, I don't think there's going to be any reallocation of the sheriff's office budget. I think that's going to remain what it is. There's going to be perhaps more focus on doing sort of the infrastructure, sidewalk, street, drainage projects in underserved neighborhoods than there have been in the past. There's going to be probably a push towards more transparency in terms of body cameras, but I don't think it's going to get as far as having like a civilian review board. So, there will be change. It's not going to be revolutionary change. It's going to be evolutionary. And it really depends, I think, on whether it's something that takes place over months or years. If it's just whatever happens in the next few months, it's not going to be a dramatic change. If it's something that continues, and a lot of that will have to do with future elections, then yes, it will have over time, a more significant, substantial change for all those issues in Jacksonville.
People are emailing us, meanwhile, about the Axe Handle event downtown yesterday. They said, please remind everyone we are in a pandemic and we were advised of a 50-person limit. So a lot of us did watch it online rather than go downtown to the park. Thanks for that. It's our Friday roundtable as we talk about the top stories of the week. 549-2937 to join us. We want to move on now and talk about some other big headlines from the week. Let's talk about the return to school. Duval County Public Schools, we learned, were ordered by the state to stop publishing COVID-19 data so families could see which schools have positive cases. That's raised a lot of eyebrows around town. At the same time, Duval County public officials say there are nearly 10,000 students that are still unaccounted for. 9,700 students are enrolled, but they have not connected with their school, either online or in person. AG Gankarski, let's begin with the first half of this. According to the Duval County Public Schools, they were initially publishing positive COVID cases to let the public know where the COVID is across the school system. The state told them to stop. The state of Florida has come under heavy criticism for, it's perceived anyway, muzzling information about this pandemic and telling health departments not to give guidance to local school districts about how to reopen schools. What is the thinking in Tallahassee about this strategy and how they're getting data about the pandemic out to the public?
Yeah, I mean, we've discussed at length over the last few months the Sanders administration massaging data regarding the way it presents its COVID positives and so on. I mean, that's led to a lot of distrust on the level. But when you look at what's happening at the schools, it's sort of a microcosmic thing because, you know, Duval wanted to publish the data. The administration didn't want it out there. We've seen that story before. But the context now is the lawsuit between the teachers union and the state of Florida regarding whether the state provided the conditions for schools open safely for the people actually working in them, the teachers. A Leon County judge ruled with the union. DeSantis and Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran are waiting on an appeal. They're 100% confident their appeal will prevail. And, I mean, realistically, DeSantis said this yesterday, even if they don't prevail, it doesn't matter because parents and, you know, if they're waiting 3 weeks for a ruling and, you know, they're used to their kids going back to school, they're basically going to say, we're used to this already. So, you know, he thinks that whatever happens to this process, it's a net win for his administration. And really, if it gets to the Supreme Court, it's going his way anyway because it's stacked with the Sanders appointees.
Hmm. Okay. Charles Griggs, what about that? You know, in Duval County, for the first 9 weeks of school anyway, parents can either choose to keep their kids on virtual learning at home, or they can, if they're elementary school students, send them to school full time. If they're older students, they can do a hybrid model where they go to school a couple of days a week and at home the rest of the week. That could change after the first 9 weeks, depending on where the positive case numbers are. And so, you know, for the majority of students and parents around the state, what's happening in the courts won't really affect their day-to-day reality. That said, as AG pointed out, the teachers union in Florida has sued over this. Older teachers in particular have really balked at going back into the classroom, despite all of the precautions that are being taken to protect them and the kids. They're worried about getting sick. They're worried about dying.
Yeah, the district here and across the state, many of these school districts are trying their best to provide as much information to parents so they can make educated decisions on how they're going to proceed with allowing or homeschooling their students, their children. The choice not to release information from a scientific standpoint is always going to be a bad choice because what you are not allowing yourself to do is have full context of what's really going on. It would do the government, they would do themselves a favor if they would just collect as much data as they could and then release as much information as possible and use that information while they're doing so to also let that information, that science, drive their decision making instead of, trying to create a narrative for an ideological benefit. And if they can't use that information, if they can't aggregate that data, they don't have the capacity to do so. There are willing researchers out here in the community all over the place, willing to take a deep dive into what's really going on and how to best inform people on how to make decisions. That's what it's all about. When you start pitting science versus ideology, you're going to get some bad choices. And this pandemic has been prolonged because of that.
And
the evidence says that.
And we're seeing the ramifications play out in so many ways. David Bauerlein, as the Times Union reports today, nearly 10,000 kids in Duval County public schools are unaccounted for. That's extraordinary. The school district hasn't heard from those families. They haven't checked in. They're not attending school.
Yeah, it's really alarming. They're coming out of the gate that perhaps those families are confused, don't know, reluctant to make a choice between the brick and mortar versus a virtual school. There has been a lot of, the school didn't start the way it usually does on the usual calendar. It's just been a confusing situation. Sounds like the school district is doing the right thing to try and reach out individually and contact those families because every day that goes by, that's a lost day for those kids to be part of the school and to really hit the ground running. So I don't think I've so unexpected that that would have been part of the fallout of all this would be that you have thousands of students who are enrolled, but phantom students. They're not actually in a virtual school or in the brick and mortar school.
Right.
So hopefully they can get that figured out quickly.
It's our Friday Media Roundtable, if you're just tuning in, with David Bauerlein, Charles Griggs, Claire Goforth, and A.G. Gankarski, our panel today. And your calls. Let us know how you think school is going across the community at 549-2937. Claire, here is a tweet from Daniel. The Department of Health report that was put up and subsequently taken down pointed out that 68% of positive cases in schools in the first 2 weeks were staff. That was before DCPS had opened. This is what we were discussing a minute ago. AG said that people are concerned the state is massaging the data, that we're not getting good data. Parents are concerned that there might be a higher caseload in the schools than what we're being told. This is not necessarily bringing confidence that we can get through this time and put it in the rearview mirror, because we need accurate data in order to rest this pandemic to the ground. We need to know what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, people really have no reason to be confident in the DeSantis administration on being transparent about COVID-19. They have proven time and again that rather than provide us with accurate, timely information, what they want to do is suppress information to the greatest extent possible. I would think that some of those 10,000 children who, as David interestingly called them, phantom students, that some of them are not in school because parents don't have any confidence in the state to provide them with data. And even when the district, as in this case, tries to do the right thing and report what the positive test rates are in different schools, they tell them to shut it down. I mean, this is no laughing matter. We are in a deadly pandemic, and we are gratefully seeing the numbers of deaths and positive cases trend downward. But what happens if in, say, 6 weeks from now, those cases start spiking again? Many fear a second wave in the fall, just as happened in the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. If that happens, under the state order, will schools be forced to stay open, have their brick and mortar facilities open, regardless of what the numbers are showing? Or will people on the local level be empowered to make a decision for their community? That's the question that the DeSantis administration seems to say, that's our call, not yours. And we can all agree that there are benefits to students being able to attend school in person, numerous benefits. But if those benefits also come at the deaths of their family members and potentially themselves, because there have been some children who have died of this disease, is it worth it?
Yeah. AG, what about that? If we do see a second wave of coronavirus in the fall, how do you see that impacting the politics of schools wanting local control over whether to continue to offer in-person class or decide to go all virtual?
You know, I think the tribal wound districts are going to be like Miami-Dade and the Orlando area, because they've had the higher rates of incidents throughout this pandemic, and they're more inclined to be politically oppositional to the administration. The DeSantis team, they're betting on a couple of things. They say that kids aren't likely to infect adults, so they don't worry about the kids bringing the disease home to parents. They cite what happened in child care centers that were open during the pandemic as evidence that spread doesn't happen in the same way among the young. The caveat there is the older the student, some studies say, the more likely that, you know, infections may transmit to adults. But, you know, they're making a bet that the clinical consequences for young people aren't going to be significant. And, you know, they place the burden on local school districts to figure out, teacher allocation. Of course, Richard Corcoran, the Commissioner of Education, came out last week and said that teachers who didn't show up because of concerns over this, walking out or wildcat strikes or whatever, would be terminated. And then he walked it back to say, well, that'd be a decision of locals, et cetera, et cetera. But the DeSantis administration is playing hardball with the teachers, sort of like Reagan did with the air traffic controllers in the early 80s, sort of a union-busting move to put them in their place. I mean, and that's a hilarious way to cap off the so-called Year of the Teacher that the DeSantis administration, you know, christened about a year ago when they were kicking off their proposal for pay raises for new teachers. So
right.
This is the Year of the Teacher ends with a lawsuit.
Yeah, absolutely right. And let me make note of another big headline from the week, this from the Times Union. They report that the private utility company NextEra was willing to pay $11 billion to take over JEA. The Times Union, of course, led on coverage of the failed effort to privatize the utility, demonstrating its immense value to the civic life of this community. I encourage everyone to go to the website savethenews.org and let your senators know you value local news coverage as they consider whether to add local newsrooms to PPP funding in the next coronavirus relief bill. David Bauerlein, the TU also is reporting that attorneys learned that the payouts for privatizing JEA could have been in the hundreds of millions of dollars. This was the bonus plan that JEA was trying to put together for its top executives if they were able to sell off the utility to NextEra, Florida Power and Light, as they're also known. And so we're getting even now more information about what was really going on with the numbers in this attempt to privatize JEA, which the voters loudly let city officials know they didn't want. And they learned about this through your colleagues, you and your colleagues reporting at the Florida Times Union. So the Florida Times Union basically saved this community hundreds of millions of dollars. And I want to give you all kudos for that. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you've learned this week in the ongoing federal and city council investigation into the JEA privatization attempt?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Melissa, for what you said about the work we've done. Very much appreciate that. And, you know, basically the gist of it is, in simple terms, the higher the sales price for JEA, the more the employees, in particular the executives of JEA, would have generated from this bonus plan, which would have, as one council member, turned executives into millionaires all over the city. And it was never, information was never provided, allowed, certainly, to board members when they voted to approve this bonus plan. A lot of them said they had no idea that was the ramification of it. And if you step back, too, it's just bizarre that anybody ever thought that would be a good idea to begin with when you had something like JEA that already was public opposition to selling it, and then to do the idea that not only were you going to sell it or try to sell it, but also have basically people get rich off the sale who were engineering the sale. It just eventually caught up, and that caused the whole thing to really fall apart in terms of the push to sell it. And we've been continuing to find a lot of interesting documents. My colleagues Nathan Rowe and Chris Hong have some more interesting coverage that is online today and will be in the newspaper over the weekend, just about how there was a lot of people knew about this on the inside of JEA, but they still were plowing forward with it, and eventually it just ran into this big brick wall.
Yeah. Now, Charles Griggs, coming out of the TU's investigation into JEA, along with other media outlets, including my own, there is a city council inquiry into this, which has been public. The public can observe it. There's also an ongoing federal grand jury investigation, which is, of course, secret. And the big question I think everyone has who's been following this whole affair is, will this grand jury hand down indictments, and will it find that the mayor's administration was involved in this whole attempt to privatize? We just don't know the answers to that yet.
That's the $11 billion question, Melissa. Will there be any indictments, or what is to come from the city council investigation? We're very much unclear on what the outcomes could be. What kind of recommendations could they make once they file their report, once they post a report? The investigative committee obviously was continued from Scott Wilson's administration, and the work plows through. But David and the TU have been doing a great job of leading the way in this work. And it's unfortunate that a lot of this information we're being brought to light this way. It seems that something as important as the attempt to explore, as they say, privatization of our utility would have been something that would have been that we would have been discussing out in the open. I don't see the harm. You know, I think most of the public doesn't either see the harm of knowing what some of these people valued the JEA at during this whole discussion. And that is problematic. That's one of the things that's been problematic is why was it so secretive leading up to the point where these bids were being discussed out of town, no less.
Right. And Claire Goforth, you know, we are in the middle now of a pandemic and a recession. So knowing how much money might have gone to private interests and individuals, in light of what we know now about the city's economic challenges, I think it becomes even more salient, even more important to understand that the city could have really been on the hook for a lot of money. And the ratepayers would have paid the price. Our rates would have gone up. Full disclosure, I know your husband works for JEA. But, you know, the ratepayers did not want this, and they made that clear. And they continue to follow this process.
You know, the ratepayers don't like it when they're misled. And I think that what the administration did in this case was just continually, I hate to say it, but lie. And we're not involved. It's nothing to do with us. It's as though they do not trust the public to take the information that is true and make their own decision. Instead, with this, you know, leading us around by the nose with all of this, it's not our doing. It's insulting to the average citizen. And I mean, you know, if we want to have an honest, open conversation about whether or not it would be better for the city to divest of what's been called its golden goose, let's do that. But, you know, to lead us around like this and come up with this ridiculous scheme that would have enriched a few executives and continue to lie about that, I mean, it's despicable. I mean, I'm really interested to see how the federal inquiry goes. And I mean, maybe city council will do something meaningful on this, but maybe they'll just say a lot of stuff and then nothing will really change, as has been the tradition of Jacksonville. But, you know, I think a lot of people have breathed a sigh of relief that this sale has been killed the second time that the Curry administration tried to do it. And, you know, kudos to the Times Union and WJCT and so many other outlets that have been dogged on this, of course, to you at the forefront. But, you know, I think it's left a bad taste in people's mouths, quite frankly.
Thank you for that. And again, go to savethenews.org. Enter your name to let your senators know that you expect them to support local news, particularly local newspapers like the Times Union. David Bauerlein repping the TU today. Thank you, David. And also Charles Griggs, A.G. Gankarski, and Claire Goforth with us. Thanks to all four of you guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Melissa. You
do the
same.
Thank you, Melissa.
And up next, local restaurants support racial justice in a special fundraiser this weekend. We'll tell you about it and how you can be part of it after this.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A mini stroke, or TIA, happens when blood is briefly blocked from the brain. It often warns of a looming stroke and requires immediate medical attention.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Storm season is here, and JEA is doing everything possible to prepare. And you can too, by updating your contact information and signing up for alerts. You can stay up to date on power restoration efforts. Update your contact info today at JEA.com.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. Include supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorm.org.
On the next Fresh Air, a new strategy devised by epidemiologists and economists to defeat COVID-19 even before a vaccine is found. We talk with Alexis Madrigal about his latest article in The Atlantic and about his work as co-founder of the COVID-19 Tracking Project, which collects and publishes data from all 50 states about COVID testing and patient outcomes. Join us
tomorrow at noon here on WJCT News 89.9.
It's happened again.
I'm not sad. I'm not sorry. I'm angry. And I'm tired.
Protests erupted across the U.S. after the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. It's a surreal backdrop to the Republican convention, where speakers put a positive spin on both Trump and the USA. Protests, fires, hurricanes, and the RNC, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, local restaurants supporting the racial justice movement across the country are having a special fundraiser, and it's going on Saturday. Mariah Salvet of Southern Roots Filling Station, a great restaurant, is on the line now with a preview. Mariah, good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So this is called Southern Restaurants for Racial Justice, and nearly 24 local restaurants are participating. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, we're super excited. So our first initiative was in June. We partnered with Color for Change and the Southern Restaurants for Racial Justice, and we raised, collectively in the South, raised over $100,000 towards Color for Change. And they saw such a great response that they wanted to do it again this August. So we are partnering with the Lee Initiative, which is a group out of Kentucky. They raise money for restaurant workers, farmers, and others in need in the culinary community. And so in the partnership, they are focusing on Southern-owned Black businesses. And we're really excited. I mean, I'm really overwhelmed by the response that we've gotten here in Jacksonville of the restaurants that want to participate.
Yeah. So this on Saturday, these are some of the restaurants that will be doing this. Yours, Southern Roots Filling Station, Taverna in San Marco, 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield, House of Leaf and Bean. They are at Beach in San Pablo. Great vegetarian restaurant. Congaree in Penn Farm. The Black Sheep Group. That's Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether restaurants. Community Loaves in Murray Hill. Great place. Vagabond Coffee. Another great place. So basically, is this right? All we have to do is go eat or get a coffee at one of these places, and a portion of the sale will go to this movement. Is that right?
Yes. So all the participating restaurants have agreed to donate 10% of their what they make in the day of their sales to the Lee Initiative. And as a business owner right now, that's a really hard ask. So I'm just super touched that all these places showed up and said yes, wanting to make this big commitment to racial justice, especially in the South and especially in the restaurant industry that's just being hit so hard right now. And if you're following super quarantine protocol, you can also go directly to the website. It's southernrestaurantsforracialjustice.com and donate directly there. But obviously, we would love for you to show up and support your local restaurants that have agreed to do this.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about how restaurants are coping amidst this pandemic, including your own Southern Roots Filling Station at Park and King.
Yeah, I mean, to say it's a challenge is an understatement. It's been just a series of like pivots, just trying to figure out what is going to work for our crew, what's going to work for our community, what feels safe for us. That's been a big thing, just like weighing, you know, do we let people come in and dine? I'm not super comfortable with that as an individual, so I wouldn't ask that of my staff to then put themselves on the line like that. So it's been tough, and like on top of that, it's summer and August. Back to school is traditionally slow time. And so you add COVID to the mix and it is tough right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. And so I realize that this is a huge lift for restaurants. You're asking them to donate portions of their sales Saturday to this movement. But it is supporting Black-owned Southern businesses, and it's something the restaurant community in Jacksonville is really going all in on. So all of us need to do our part by supporting the locally owned restaurant community, because where would we be without locally owned places? Now, I mean, nothing against chain restaurants, but, you know, let's face it. It's the locally owned places that add color and life to every community in this country, and it's so easy now to support them. Order takeout. Patronize your community places. They need your help. What else should people know about Saturday, Mariah?
I think it's really cool because they're going to, so we've partnered, there's like Nashville, Savannah, Knoxville, Birmingham, Memphis, Charleston, like really awesome, great places in the South. And we're so excited to be a part of that. And the funds that we raise will be for grants that will be distributed amongst the participating cities. So just because the money is going towards, you know, the Lee Initiative in Kentucky, there will be money that will be dispersed in the form of grants to locally owned Black businesses. So I think that's really important, especially right now with everything that's going on. And then, so I also wanted to say that Brew and Sweet Theory, Biscotti's and BB's, String Sports Bar in Springfield, Shakti, Matthews and Wildcrafters is also participating. So there's tons of options, you know, like everybody's taste buds will be satisfied in dining out on Saturday.
That's great. Support one of those amazing locally owned establishments this Saturday and have something delicious to eat or drink. And you will also be supporting Black owned Southern businesses. So Mariah Salvat of Southern Roots Filling Station, thanks for all you do and hope it goes great this weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Station news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield runs digital. Make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in program, rounding up the biggest stories of the week across the Sunshine State. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. This show will rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. You can catch it then, or our podcast will be up later today. Have a great weekend. We'll connect with you again soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.